Professor Eisenberg, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, glad to have you here. I thought maybe to start, we could talk about sort of the global picture of what's going on in research and what research is being conducted by whom. What is, you know, the balance of public-private research and funding, and, you know, who essentially owns the research that is being conducted?
That's a wonderful question. Unfortunately, it's a very difficult question to answer, in part because the boundaries are much blurrier than they used to be. I think we have a picture sometimes from an earlier era. I don't know if it ever was quite true, but we imagine that in an earlier era, publicly funded research in universities pursued basic scientific knowledge, which was made freely available in the public domain, while in the private sector, we had applied research that was taking that new knowledge and translating it into practical applications and new products and processes for profit. And that was the realm of intellectual property. Now there's an increased blurring and overlap in these two spheres where it becomes difficult to distinguish the types of problems that are pursued in these two settings. One reason for that is the shift in policy that you alluded to, beginning with passage of the Bayh-Dole Act and the Stevenson-Widler Act in 1980, that has promoted patenting the results of government-sponsored research. For some agencies, this was business as usual, but for some federal funding agencies, this was a shift in direction from an era where they had thought that their mission was to make knowledge freely available. The logic of the new policy was to get business to pick up where government funding leaves off, that government pays for the early stages of research, but there's a lot more investment that needs to be made beyond that to bring new products to market. And the thought was that in the absence of intellectual property rights on the early stage discoveries, no private firm would be motivated to make that still quite risky investment in further development. The place where this has had the greatest impact has been in biomedical research. The universities have the shift in policy coincided, I think, with the emergence of the biotechnology industry. And so universities saw this as an opportunity to get a piece of the action in a promising new line of commerce. And at the same time, I think scientists were eager to play a role in this new science-based industry. So that's where you've seen the biggest shift. Mm-hmm. There are many fields of science where universities still aren't doing a lot of patenting, but in the biomedical area, there's a lot of filing of patent applications going on, certainly. I don't know that many universities are making much money off of this, but they're aggressively trying to identify discoveries with commercial potential and to spin them off into the private sector. So in this environment, you see a lot more overlap in the kind of research that's happening in the public sector and in the private sector, and you see sometimes a lot more collaboration between universities and private firms, and sometimes open rivalries between publicly funded and privately funded research initiatives in the same sphere, like you mentioned earlier, the Human Genome Project.
Sure. Well, that's a good example maybe to illustrate the case. There was the federally funded Human Genome Project, and then a private company which said, we can do this faster and cheaper and maybe better. I'm not sure exactly what their claims were. Celera, which essentially, and both of them ended up doing the same kind of work and essentially coming to a conclusion at about the same time, I believe, just recently.
Yeah, that's right. I think they had it was unclear exactly what was going on there, but it's sort of remarkable, really, to see that kind of rivalry between publicly funded and privately funded research. One theme that was played up, I think, by the media was scientific rivalry and a sort of a clash of personalities. Another theme that was highlighted in this dispute was intellectual property. You had the government saying, well, it may be that they will complete the sequence of the human genome. We're skeptical because we think our approach is more sound. But even if they do get there first, they're going to try to appropriate that as their own private property and make it accessible to their subscribers, but not to others. The response was also kind of interesting. The response was, no, we'll make something available to the public. They were the private firm was, you know, clearly trying to deflate that argument somewhat. So intellectual property seemed to play a central role, at least in justifications of the rivalry, if not in the in what was actually motivating it in the first place. One reason why we like, I guess, having private sector involvement in areas of research that the government might also be pursuing is that, you know, government research allocation tools are, you know, tend to be somewhat conservative. We have a government agency deciding how to broadly how to allocate its resources. Then we have peer review to determine what proposals get funded. Peer review is dominated by the existing scientific establishment. It's slow moving. It's slow to change its ideas. And there are political pressures to divide up the bounty of government funding. The private sector is less constrained. They can respond very quickly to new opportunities. They can shift course. They don't need to persuade slow-moving bureaucracies to go with their plan. And so often you'll see the private sector coming up with a new idea that the public sector would not fund, or that it would take a long time to get the public sector to fund.
One of the questions that this raises, though, the split between private and public, especially when we're talking about genetic information, the Human Genome Project, you know, and sequencing the human DNA, who owns the results of that research? In the case of the Human Genome Project, presumably it's the public at large. But in the case of a private company like Celera, they've done the work. They should have rights to use it. But we're talking about something. I mean, everybody has DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the term ownership is something that can mean different things.
Right. Okay.
You can create a database of information and restrict access to that. Does that mean that you own the information if the information is something that is otherwise accessible to other people? Well, maybe not. Maybe you control access to your particular database, but other people could duplicate that database and without violating any rights that you have if your whole model for extracting value from that database is simply restricting access. Mm-hmm. Ownership sometimes refers to patents. A patent gives the exclusive right to make, use, sell, or import the patented invention. Traditionally, in the area of genetics as elsewhere, the focus of the patent system has been on tangible discoveries. And when people talk about patenting genes, they're usually talking about patenting molecules or patenting materials that incorporate a particular DNA sequence, maybe a recombinant organism that can serve as the production factory for producing a protein using biotechnology techniques or something of that sort. But you're talking about tangible materials. What's at stake in the first generation of biotechnology products was those tangible molecules and patent rights on those tangible molecules. And a patent on a gene looked more or less like a patent on a drug, that it gave an effective commercial monopoly to somebody who was bringing a new therapeutic protein product to market.
Insulin or
human growth hormone or erythropoietin. That was the whole first generation of biotechnology products. When you're talking about sequencing the entire human genome, you're really talking about something very different. The tangible value, there are nuggets of tangible value in there. There are portions of the human genome that encode therapeutic proteins, things like insulin or erythropoietin. You don't necessarily know where they are, though, at the point when you're completing your sequence. And so the initial value is the value of this treasure trove of information. It's the value of having a database, in effect, of what the human DNA sequence is that others might then cull through in order to find the nuggets of valuable information that are in there. So it's not at all obvious how you use patents to capture that informational value as opposed to the tangible value of particular genes. Most of the patenting activity that's going on right now is focused on tangible genes rather than on large databases of information, but there are some preliminary efforts at trying new patenting strategies that would claim DNA sequence information stored in computer-readable medium or, mm-hmm. or something of that sort. It remains to be seen how the patent system will respond to that. But for the most part, when we're talking about this large-scale sequencing of whole genomes, the intellectual property strategy that is that matters is the database access terms rather than the patenting strategy.
So anyone's welcome to the information, but they'll have to generate it themselves, in other words.
Or pay for licensed access,
yeah. Yeah.
Which you know comes at a price. It can come for an upfront fee. It can come for a promise of a share of royalties in future discoveries made through access or that were facilitated or accelerated by having access to that database. There's different terms that are available to different kinds of subscribers.
When we're talking about patenting particular kinds of organisms, I'm wondering how this plays itself out in both the research community and in the commercial realm, where someone develops, through genetic engineering, a particular enzyme or something that produces a particular enzyme. I don't know just enough about the science of this mm-hmm. to be very dangerous, but the question essentially relates to how that information is shared among other scientists that might contribute to a greater body of knowledge. Whereas in the past, where everything is public, publicly funded and publicly available, other scientists can get at that research and build upon that. But if we essentially break off and grant patent rights to particular researchers for particular products of research, does that hold a danger that a greater sort of effort will be jeopardized?
Yes, it absolutely does. Increasingly, the discoveries that are getting patented in this arena are not simply the end products that are sold to consumers. Yeah. They're these intermediary products that are primarily of value as inputs into future research. That's primarily what universities are patenting, and that's what a lot of biotechnology companies are patenting too. And they are hoping to use their intellectual property rights to these materials, methods, DNA sequences, software, whatever, as a lever to share in the wealth that's generated by products that come out of the use of those materials.
Sure.
What this means is, first of all, that you have to pay for the use of these materials. You have to pay for access to them. You also have to pause and negotiate the terms of access, which is also an important cost, something that slows down research. More and more of the many materials that need to be exchanged in order for biomedical research to go forward come with material transfer agreements or license agreements or database access agreements that will initially say everything that you do henceforth belongs to me, and then you need to send that to a representative of your university or company that will say, we can't sign this. They renegotiate. The research gets stalled. The scientists are upset. This happens. This is a sort of a two-way problem. I think it can be a problem for universities when they're trying to bring in proprietary research tools from other institutions. They imagine, university scientists, I think, imagine sometimes that they should be exempt from infringement liability, but it's not at all clear that they're right as a matter of law. Universities that are adamant about claiming their own intellectual property rights when they're sending material out to other institutions are indignant when people treat them the same way. But as universities become harder to distinguish from other commercial actors, as they become ever more alert to the commercial potential of the research that's going on campus, firms perceive them as commercial competitors, and they're more likely to want to impose some control when they make materials available to university scientists.
We're talking during this hour of Focus 580 with Rebecca Eisenberg. She's professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School, where she teaches intellectual property and legal issues in the Human Genome Project. And we're talking about the public-private divide in research on biotechnology, a variety of issues that pertain to that. If you'd like to join us, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. speaking of the university, the public university, since this, you know, the Bayh-Dole bill in 1980, has there been a major shift in the balance of funding at the university level, in public universities, in terms of whether they're funded by the federal government or by private industry?
I think that the shift in the kinds of funding that pays for university research is less dramatic than the overall shift in funding. In the last 10 years, for the first time in I don't know how long, private funding for biomedical research has exceeded public funding. That didn't used to be the case. But I don't think that's true. I'm pretty sure that's not true for research happening in universities. At the same time, there has been an increase in private funding of research going on in universities, but I'm not sure what the magnitude of that is. I think in most universities, private funding is considerably less important than public funding in the aggregate. But I don't have numbers on that to offer.
Well, I guess the essence of the question that I would get to, though, is how does that play itself out in terms of who has access to the fruits of that research? Is it essentially the case that whatever the source of funding at the university level, because of the legal, you know, the laws that have been passed, that the university holds the rights to that and can assign those rights however it chooses?
Typically, universities do claim ownership of intellectual property in discoveries made on campus. But if they have been funded by a private firm, often that private firm will insist as a term of the funding agreement that the university offer them either an automatic license to future discoveries or preferential access to future discoveries, perhaps an option to get an exclusive license on any discoveries coming out of the research. Universities are usually willing to do that when the private firm is paying for all of the research. They're willing to promise up front that they will license, they will allocate, if the firm wants it, they will allocate rights so that the firm gets an exclusive license. They are more angry about that when that term of access comes as a condition for making a research tool available. If a scientist wants to use a molecule that is owned by a company, they want to use that in research, the company says, sure, we'll supply that molecule, but you've got to promise that any inventions that you make using our molecule will be licensed to us automatically, that we will get an automatic non-exclusive license to that discovery. And the university say, wait a minute, that's our intellectual property. We want to see what the inventions are, and then we'll figure out how we want to license them. In the case of federally sponsored research, the university can retain title to the invention, subject to certain retained rights on the part of the government. The government has the right to use the invention for government purposes or to authorize others to use the invention for government purposes. They also have certain march-in rights that if they think that the university is not handling the intellectual property properly, if they're not seeing to it that the discovery is getting commercially developed, then the agency can step in and extend a license to somebody else.
I see. So that protects the public interest in the sense of sharing the information if it's not going to be used.
Well, I think the model of how this information gets used that underlies the Bayh-Dole Act is that you have technology transfer as a unidirectional flow from universities out to the private sector for commercial development. I don't think that the crafters of that legislation had in mind the problem of universities themselves bringing technology in from the outside world and how much that process gets compromised when universities themselves become commercial proprietary actors whose activities could be commercially threatening to the future intellectual property position of the firms that they're interacting with. They created a set of rules that made some sense if technology transfer were only moving in one direction, that are a lot more complicated when you recognize that it moves in many directions and it moves back and forth.
Sounds a lot of details involved in these agreements. Essentially, are these contractual relationships? I mean, there's a legislative foundation to a lot of this, yes, in terms of federal statutes. But there are also, I mean, a lot of the details will be hammered out in contracts.
Exactly. And it's a market. It's a market. It's a new emerging market. And the parties aren't sure really what they ought to agree to. They have a belief about what's right that's based on, you know, they have disparate beliefs about what's right, I guess, that are based on an earlier era, what they imagine was prevailed in the golden age. So I think universities' starting position is that everybody should make everything freely available to them, and they should be able to use it for whatever purpose they want and shouldn't have to account for what they're doing. Whereas the company's position is, we own this, it's ours. If we're making it available to you out of the goodness of our hearts, it's fair that we should be sure that we're not, our commercial interests aren't going to be harmed by that.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. And we welcome others. The number, again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Crete on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, another important legal question besides the biological questions of new science is the area of new technology, especially in the area of computer education or distance learning. I was wondering if one got involved with distance learning and, gave the students on the computer the written lectures, or gave them an audio lecture series for the semester or the quarter, or besides that, a videotape of one's lectures throughout the entire semester. Who has the property rights to that?
You know, that's a brave new world that universities are confronting right now, and they're not at all sure how they want to proceed. You know, in the past, universities have generally taken the position that the work product of faculty members was something that they could allow the faculty members unfettered control over. You don't see a lot of universities, for example, claiming that they should own the copyright in course materials that are prepared by faculty members, even though, in theory, those are employees of the university who've been hired to create just those materials. And so under the copyright statute, under a fair reading of the copyright statute, those look like works made for hire that ought to belong to the employer. Nobody's treated them that way in the past. Now universities are concerned that the scale of the operation for distance learning and the dissemination of information over the web is so much greater that they want to be sure that they're in a position to control that and to profit from that if it proves profitable. So this has the university's interests as owner of broadly disseminated information potentially colliding with the faculty members' concerns about academic freedom and their own ability to make whatever use they want of their ideas. It's a very complex area.
Does it make any difference legally whether it's written, spoken, or videotaped?
Well, yes, it does. Copyright arises when a work is fixed in a tangible medium of expression. So a lecture in a room that's not being recorded doesn't meet that standard and is not the subject of copyright protection. If, on the other hand, you are making even an audio tape of that lecture, that amounts to a fixation, which is what triggers the application of the copyright rules. So it does make a difference, but you know, all of these background legal rules are things that can be varied by agreement between the parties. And so universities, I think, are now sorting through what it is that they think their policies ought to be on that.
So the faculty could well go to a copyright lawyer and say, I want this lecture that I just videotaped or gave to an audio transcription, I want this copywritten.
Well, copyright arises automatically. You don't even need to go to a copyright lawyer in order to get copyright. The issue is who owns the copyright. Traditionally, when you're not talking about something that has a lot of money at stake, but even when you're talking about a teaching, you know, textbook or something like that could have some money at stake, universities and faculty members have treated that work as something that belongs to the faculty member. When a faculty member goes to publish a journal article, journals routinely require faculty members to assign copyrights. Nobody says, you send this on to an office in your university to be sure that the institution is signing off on its rights. Everybody treats faculty members traditionally as the owners of those works. It's not at all clear, if you read the copyright statute, that that's right, although the longstanding practice may rise to the level of an agreement that modifies the background legal rules.
This is a new world,
exactly. This is a new world. And whatever the rules are, usually copyright rules can be reallocated. Copyright can be reallocated by written agreement. So if universities or faculty members feel strongly enough and are able to come to agreement, their agreement would generally govern.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We're a little past our midpoint with Rebecca Eisenberg, professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. We're talking about the public-private divide in funding and research and ownership of biotechnology and a variety of other things. And she'll be speaking at 4 o'clock today at the auditorium of the College of Law, 504 East Pennsylvania Avenue on the campus of the University of Illinois, and people are welcome to attend that. They're also welcome to call in and talk with us. We have one caller waiting, would welcome others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Another listener in Urbana on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. I just wish that people understood more that, like, for example, in the early days of the software for personal computers, there was this culture of just sharing information and ideas, which really made the whole thing flower. Microsoft was founded in 1975, but I understand they didn't get their first patent having to do with computers until 1988, you know, 13 years later. And even IBM, didn't really get started basing what they were doing on patents. I keep seeing, it looks to me a little bit like in our history when we settled the West, if somebody had found the passes through the Rocky Mountains and insisted on putting some sort of toll gate on it, you know, what would that have done to our history? But I had a question in Illinois. There's this law, I understand, that I've heard about, that there's this prohibition about the university competing with free enterprise. And like, for example, here in Champaign-Urbana, PrairieNet is a nonprofit internet service provider, and it's prohibited from competing too aggressively with private enterprise in that industry. And I don't know if that's common in a lot of states or not, but if it is, or even if it isn't, have you had any indication that because universities are becoming more engaged in free enterprise, that these kind of legal restrictions are likely to be swept aside?
That's a very interesting question. I hadn't heard about this Illinois statute before. I think the presumption behind the federal rules, the federal law, the Bayh-Dole Act, et cetera, is not that universities are going to be competing with private industry, but that they are going to be kind of like an advanced scouting mission that's going to identify new technological opportunities and then hand them off to the private sector. Of course, as a practical matter, as you have new firms in the biotechnology industry emerging in market niches that lie somewhere between the kind of research that goes on in universities and the kind of research, the kind of end product development that goes on in more traditional firms, they do start looking more like competitors. So I can see how those laws could be very tricky, and how they might become a problem. I don't know if there's been much litigation under that law, but that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't know about that either, but. Should probably look into it. We have another caller waiting on line number 4 in Marshall. Let's talk with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a practical question for myself. I'm in academia, kind of one of those fuzzy areas for copywriting. But maybe it would have interest to the listeners generally. A colleague of mine and I created a workbook for students, and it was funded by a private foundation with all the money up front. It was given to the, of course, to the university, who then provided us with release time because they had the money to replace us. And so we created a workbook, which is now being used by students in our program. And we put our little copyright at the bottom of it, a little symbol and our names. And at some point, when we're completely finished and have it evaluated, we would like to try to publish it. Are we at risk somehow that there would be a claim by, I don't know, the foundation or the university that they somehow would be eligible to profit from this?
You know, there would be some legal basis for the university's claim, certainly. I'm not sure about the foundation's claim. I'd have to take a look at your contract. But as a practical matter, that has not been the approach that universities have taken. Universities have
before. Generally, they don't, but they might be able to.
Well, if you read the copyright statute, it sure looks like these works created by faculty members who are employed by universities ought to count as works made for hire. You should look at your employment agreement and see if there's anything that specifically addresses that, your employment agreement with the university, because all of these rules are variable by agreement of the parties. For the most part, though, what I think faculty rely on is the longstanding tradition that universities don't claim ownership of copyright in scholarly or teaching materials that have been created by faculty members.
I was just wondering if we would be in a stronger position since the money for the time that was used to develop this workbook was not directly paid for by the university, although we were employed there at the time, and by virtue of being there, we got the grant, of course. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, but I'm not sure what the terms of your agreement, the agreement between your university and the foundation were. Probably the foundation was making a grant to the university,
yes,
and the university was paying your salary.
That's right.
And it's expected in the course of, that academics are going to get grants. So I don't see that as particularly important.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. You mentioned that historically universities have not made that claim. Would that have some legal weight if there were a dispute? The fact that they had not.
It probably would have some legal weight.
Yeah.
The statute seems to contemplate that the rules will only be varied by written agreement, and that's the problem. So you might need to find some place where this longstanding policy is documented in university manuals or something of that sort. But it probably would have some legal weight. I think judges would be moved by that.
Okay. We have a couple callers to talk with. We'll go next to a listener in southeastern Illinois on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I missed the beginning of the program, so I'm not even sure whether you're in science or in copyright law.
I'm in patent law, actually.
Patent law. Well, I've wondered about copyright law for some time. The old law, of course, in the United States was 26 years or 28 years and then renewable once. And the new law is creator plus 50 years. I mean, the copyright holder plus 50 years after the...
It's grown even longer.
Well,
it just keeps growing and growing.
Is it longer than 50 years?
Yeah.
What is it now?
I think it's life plus 70 or 75 years or something like that.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Well, what I was wondering, though, is you can understand there would be a time at least when it would come into public domain if it's an individual. But what happens if the copyright is held by an institution that just keeps going?
No, there's a specified term. And, again, copyright is not my field. I think it's a 90-year term for a work for hire that's owned by an institution. So they don't have it's not that it goes on forever. But in effect, it does go on forever. I mean, this is ridiculous. Copyright ought to come to an end, and old works ought to enter the public domain.
I agree. I don't believe, is it required anymore by the copyright notice to have a date? So how can anybody looking at a book that's copyrighted, if there's not a date on it, how would they know when the 90 years is up?
you know, again, copyright is not my field, but I know that when the U.S. acceded to the Berne Convention on the Protection of Literary Works a number of years ago, that convention limits the formal requirements that the members of that treaty may impose for copyright protection. And I believe that that eliminated the notice requirement. Previously, under U.S. law, you did need to say copyright and then the name of the owner and then the date of first publication. I don't believe you do need to do that anymore. There are some advantages to doing that. U.S. copyright law gives favorable remedies to people who include that notice. But if you haven't included that notice, that does not end your copyright claim.
So there's really no way for somebody seeing a very old book to know whether it's in public domain now or not.
Well, if it's very old, you can figure it's in the public domain. But again, I'm not on top of all those rules. I don't teach copyright law. I'm not a copyright scholar.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We can save that for another hour, I'm sure. Probably spend an hour talking about copyright. We have a couple callers. I have some other questions, but I'll defer to them. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I have a slight tangent with regard to copyright to mention, but it has more to do with individuals. Is that something you would entertain? Do you have time for that?
I don't know. It depends on what it is. I mean, really, my familiarity with the copyright system is just that I'm a person who writes. It's not because not any professional familiarity that I have.
Well, I was going to offer it as a contribution. I have gotten into genealogy, and one of the pieces of information I've come across, which was posted by Ancestry.com's website, was with regard to things that individuals might publish with regard to the genealogy. And the rule of thumb that they said was that if it's data that's publicly available, you can't copyright the data. All you can copyright is the format in which you place it. So, for instance, I posted an 1863 voter list, which got passed down in our family, and I can presumably my introduction is protected, but not the data itself. And apparently there's a problem that some people think that they can protect their work by introducing errors so that they can see if somebody has taken their data, and this causes real problems for people doing genealogy, even if it seems like it might be a minor error to introduce. So I just thought I would pass that along as a tangent, because more and more people are realizing that the issues of copyright can affect themselves. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for the call. Well, we will move on to a listener in Iowa, I suppose, the state of Iowa, I think, on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a question for your guest. There's a lot of it deals with the antiretroviral drugs that were basically developed in the universities with mostly, as I understand it, with publicly funded studies. And somehow the drug companies were able to acquire patents on these drugs. And it's in the news now, I guess, with Africa and wanting to develop their own generic drugs. And in that respect, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine. It was written by Tina Rosenberg, I believe.
I read that.
It was something to deal with Brazil and the way they're developing their own drugs for AIDS or HIV. And I was wondering how they were able to get around the patent law on that.
Yeah, okay, that's an excellent question. Patent laws are national in scope. A patent in the U.S. gives you no rights in Brazil. Now, there are patent treaties in force that require members to provide certain minimum standards of protection. In particular, the what's called the TRIPS Agreement, the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Properties, that impose restrictions on national patent laws so that countries can no longer say, for example, drugs may not be patented in Brazil. These provisions represented a change in policy for many countries, and so they have a phase-in period. Many of the antiretroviral drugs that are now being made in Brazil are prior to that point. They're not patented in Brazil. Even when a drug is patented in a country, the international treaties allow countries to have certain public health limitations on patent rights that they can address. So even if these drugs are patented in Brazil or South Africa, that doesn't necessarily prevent the government in a public health emergency from getting access to generic versions of those drugs. You know, there's always disagreement about what these provisions mean and whether the country has gone too far. Right now, you have the drug companies challenging a South African law that's attempting to make drugs more readily available, and you know, remains to be seen how that will pan out. But countries have some latitude in how strong. How strong rights they want to allocate to the owners of drug patents.
Yeah, I was just curious. It's kind of a political question in my mind, being these countries can develop it much more cheaply than our pharmaceutical companies or the international.
Well, they're not developing the drugs. They're copying the drugs. You can copy the drugs a lot more cheaply than you can develop them, and that's why the drugs are so expensive.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks very much. There's another area of some conflict between private and public interests in terms of germplasm and the improvements to crop plants and so forth. Whereas, you know, there are public institutions that are trying to develop, you know, more robust, maybe more higher protein sorts of varieties, and there are private. Obviously, private companies that want to maintain their ownership on the technology that they're developing. And I guess I'm wondering where there is a compelling public interest in feeding the world, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Are there overriding legal principles or agreements that would deal with those sorts of conflicts?
Yeah, there are some agreements. The agriculture area is an important area that has not traditionally been dominated by straightforward utility patents. There have been special plant variety protection statutes in effect in different countries, and the countries do have more latitude in deciding what form of intellectual property rights to allow for people who develop new germplasm. So you don't need to have the strong patent model that prevails for drug products, for example, for new seeds. That's one important difference. There are big differences in the economics of the industries, as well as differences in the importance to countries of having free access to new discoveries. I don't want to say too much about that because I am stepping a little bit outside of the bounds of my expertise.
Okay. If this is also outside the bounds, just let me know that. But in the case of, for example, Roundup Ready corn, just to use an example of something that is used by a lot of farmers around here, this is a particular variety that is patented, yes, by Monsanto holds that. Hope I'm not getting that confused with some other company. But this is something that is relatively new in our economic experience, although not perhaps entirely new because we've had hybrid seed for many, many years. But now the fruits of biotechnology research conducted by a company are placed in the hands of farmers who then are restricted by a very specific contract as to what they can and cannot do with this thing that they're buying. On the other hand, somebody may want to use the research that went into making this to come up with an improved variety of, for example, Roundup Ready corn. And yet there are restrictions for doing that. Are there not?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, these plant variety protection legislation schemes were more generous in their exemptions from infringement liability for farmers and for people doing research to create new strains than is the basic patent statute. So an important question is the applicability of utility patents in this area. There's actually a case that's going up to the U.S. Supreme Court that might give us some clarity on that issue. But for now, it seems to be the case that at least under U.S. law, law. These life sciences companies are assuming that their genetically engineered crop strains are eligible for regular utility patent protection.
We're just about at the point we're going to have to stop. Sort of a global question for you, and you can say whatever you want about this. It just seems that as information becomes more valuable, we're in the information age,
mm-hmm.
The mechanisms for governing its use, ownership, assigning the ownership of the information and so forth are so much more important than they ever have been. And I guess the question is where and when are those decisions made about how we decide that?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and it's not a question that I think is squarely addressed by our existing intellectual property schemes that are on the books. I think traditionally the objects of protection of copyright and patent legislation has not been information as such, and information is a unique thing that raises different concerns. You know, patent laws traditionally were addressed to machines and other tangible technological advances, and copyrights were addressed to the form of writing, but not the the underlying information, as was highlighted by one caller. Information has been considered outside the scope of what's protected under these regimes traditionally. And so that has made the terms of contracts more important so far. We have had various proposals for database protection that have been advanced, and those create an opportunity for people who are affected by the scope of that protection to step in and address the problem in the legislative proposals. I hope that universities will step forward and recognize their interests as users of information. I fear that too often in the past, universities, when they have entered into the political fray, have been picturing themselves primarily as owners of intellectual property rather than weighing in on the side of users.
We're going to have to stop since we're here at the end of our time, but I will say that for those of you who would like to know more on this topic, you'll have a chance to later today. Our guest, Rebecca Eisenberg, will be speaking at 4 o'clock today at the auditorium of the College of Law, 504 East Pennsylvania Avenue on the campus, and that's open to the public if you'd like to attend. And to you, Rebecca Eisenberg, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Jack. It's been fun.